Sure, the Fed's in Jackson Hole and the president is on the vineyard and Congress is wherever Congress goes this time of year. But you know what? The American economy waits for no one. There is business to do, people, and we shall do it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the 21st of August. Good, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We will begin today with that lifeblood of American business, advertising. SoundCloud, which is, for those not necessarily up to speed, a site that offers free streaming audio and, importantly, has heretofore offered said audio ad-free, has now decided it does indeed need to make some money after all. So the site's 175 million users are going to have to learn to deal with ads. That transition poses no small risks to all kinds of tech companies as they look for ways to turn a profit. Marketplace's Queen of Kim gets us going.
The people who use SoundCloud, both musicians and listeners, are used to doing almost everything for free on the website and without ads. Now that ads are coming, will this alienate them?
I don't think people expect things to be ad-free forever.
Karen Allen is a digital music consultant, and she says most consumers understand that tech companies have costs and need to make money.
Either the artists have to pay to upload their music, or fans have to pay to listen, or there has to be advertising.
But Roger Entner of Recon Analytics says SoundCloud is putting a clever marketing spin on its announcement.
That the money that they get from the advertising is for altruistic reasons.
He says SoundCloud isn't punching the we need to pay our bills angle. Instead, SoundCloud says the majority of the advertising money will go to the musician. That spin is working on James Peck, a musician who goes by the name of Memrex on SoundCloud.
I think it's going to be a good thing for the content creators.
But Peck says SoundCloud must be respectful of the indie music community that helped build up the site. The fear is that with money to be made, big music labels will put more music on SoundCloud.
What starts to happen is SoundCloud wants to make more money and offers them advertising opportunities such as being pushed to the top of the page.
And the big labels often bring in a different crowd.
You know, you'll have more of your like 13-year-old female demographic coming in there.
Peck says nothing against 13-year-old girls, but they sort of kill the indie vibe. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
All right, keeping with our theme, a second tributary, if you will, of American business, the deal, the merger and acquisition. We told you the other day about the dollar store wars, how Dollar General is trying to take over Family Dollar, offering $9 billion for the deal. But now Family Dollar has said, nuh-uh, it prefers a smaller offer from Dollar Tree. Family Dollar says that if it does go ahead and merge with its biggest competitor, remember, that would be Dollar General, people keep up, it fears regulators would consider it a monopoly. Seriously? A dollar store monopoly? Sally Herships goes there.
Let's review the issue here. Monopolies are bad because they mean no competition and the potential for one company to control prices. But dollar stores?
They're dollar stores. Inherently, they aren't looking to raise prices.
Rob Campanino is head of consumer research for SSR.
As a matter of fact, that pricing tends to be a race to the bottom.
He says it's unlikely a merger between Dollar General and Family Dollar would mean a substantial antitrust risk. But for consumers, the fear of a monopoly can depend on where you live.
In very dense environments where there's a store every couple of blocks, you don't worry as much because there are so many competitive choices.
Scott Hempel teaches antitrust law at Columbia. But, he says, if you live out in the country near a merged dollar store,
but not close to a Walmart, then there's a real concern that the firms, if they merged, would be able to raise their prices.
George Hay teaches law at Cornell. He was also chief of economic policy for the antitrust division of the Justice Department. He says he thinks it's highly unlikely there'll be an antitrust issue with a dollar store. But that doesn't mean companies shouldn't be careful. When United and Continental merged,
a group of lawyers brought a case on behalf of consumers who would be adversely affected. At the end of the day, that challenge did not succeed. But it did cause problems.
But Hay says the chain's antitrust concerns are probably just an excuse to let it go with a different offer. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Ah, 17,000, how we have missed you. Up again on Wall Street, a record high in point of fact. Details, numbers, you know the drill. You want to know how bad the drought is in the western United States? Here is how bad the drought is in the western United States. In the journal Science today, a study that shows so much water is missing that the ground is actually rising. I have no idea how it works, but using GPS data, scientists say there is what's called an uplift effect in California's mountains of more than half an inch. And they estimate the water deficit at nearly 63 trillion gallons, which would be, if you spread it out over the entire western United States, a 4-inch layer of water. Here in California, meanwhile, farmers in this state's multi-billion-dollar agriculture industry are pumping groundwater at record rates, and some of it is selling for record prices. From KQED, Lauren Sommer has that story.
In a good year, California's farmers get most of their water from rivers and reservoirs. But in a drought like this one, most of the water comes from below ground. You can think of it as an underground reservoir, and that reservoir is drying up.
When the water is gone, all the farming is gone.
Billy Grissom is a Central Valley farmer and just one of many who have lined up to speak at this county public meeting. Most of these farmers are relying on groundwater from wells on their land this year. When that happens, the water levels drop, kind of like having too many straws in the same glass. So Grissom has had to deepen his wells.
I had to add 40 feet. I have the bill right here from Shannon Pump.
Grissom is one of the lucky ones. It's tough to get an appointment with companies that drill water wells. They're booked up for months.
A lot of people's wells are going dry. I mean, we are overdrafting the water, and it is agriculture.
That's Merced County Supervisor Deirdre Kelsey. Groundwater pumping doesn't have to be reported in California. There's virtually no regulation of it, unlike in other western states. So farmers don't know how much their neighbors are taking until the water starts drying up. But at this meeting, county supervisors are hearing about a case that's on the record because the groundwater is being sold.
This is common practice.
Steve Sloan is one of two ranchers looking to sell up to 4 billion gallons of groundwater. Under California law, he owns the groundwater under his property. On today's market, it could make him millions.
Water exchanges, water transfers have been done for over 30 years. This is how we survive collectively as an ag industry in California.
The water will be sent 50 miles away to the other side of the Central Valley. Farmers there are in even worse shape and are looking at ripping out almond orchards, says local water manager Anthea Hansen.
We're in crisis mode. I have trees I need to keep alive. We don't need large quantities of water to do that.
Hansen is trying hard to make her case at this public meeting, but farmers in this region don't want to see water flowing out of the county, like Mike Gallo.
What's going to happen when you take this much water out of an aquifer? We're on the same aquifer. I don't know what it's going to do. Nobody knows what it's going to do.
The federal referee in all of this is the Bureau of Reclamation, and it's approved the sale. So under current law, there's little that local county officials can do. In the big picture, Jeff Mount says these water sales do have their benefits. He's a geologist and senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California.
One of the ways to deal with some of the shortages is to let water start moving, let the markets start moving water, and that actually increases your economic efficiency.
But Mount says there are caveats. Groundwater is being dramatically overpumped in a lot of places.
You also have to do it in ways that don't harm other parties. And if you start drying up your neighbor's wells to sell water to somebody else, then you are causing harm.
Some counties have taken matters into their own hands and effectively banned the sale of groundwater outside county lines. And California lawmakers are looking at regulating groundwater for the first time. Two bills are being considered in this legislative session and would have to pass by the end of the month. In San Francisco, I'm Lauren Sommer for Marketplace.
Every now and then, a good action movie is the perfect thing, fake violence and all. But there are some where you just have to stop and say, wait, come on, really? Case in point, the proposed spinoff of the Sylvester Stallone Expendables series, where all the leads are women, and it's to be called, I kid you not, Expendables, B-E-L-L-E-S. And after the third installment of the franchise basically tanked its opening weekend at the box office, well, one does have to wonder what the heck people are thinking in Hollywood. We usually take our cinematic wonderings to Wesley Morris. He's the film critic at Grantland. Hey, Wesley, good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Kai. How are you?
I'm good, except, come on, Expendables, are you kidding me? Seriously?
Yes, sir. I mean, look, potentially, yes, sir. There's no Sigourney Weaver just backed out the other day, if she was even in. I mean, I guess they offered it to her, and she perhaps smartly said no. She probably saw that $15 million, the third installment made over the weekend, and was just like...
Yeah, of the men's version
of
this
we'd be remiss in not mentioning that our friend Rousey is also... She's the token woman in the film.
Our friend
Ronda Rousey.
Oh, Ronda Rousey, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see it? You didn't see it. You didn't. Did you?
Of course, I saw. I'm a professional critic, my friend. I don't pick and choose.
Was it as bad as the box office would imply?
The problem with this movie, and it's the problem with this whole series, is that it has this idea that the thing that we really want is the great action stars all together giving us movies they don't make anymore. But there's kind of a reason we don't make those movies anymore. And this movie just is sort of plowing forward. And instead of giving us a camp version of that, it takes itself very seriously while pretending to have a sense of humor. It's so bad.
How has this summer been in your professional movie critic opinion? I mean, there have been some hits, but how have we done?
Well, the box office is, I think, pretty good. I think that quality-wise, it's been higher movie to movie than other summers. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like a risky summer, but, I mean, if you look at some of the things that have happened in these individual blockbusters, they've been some interesting things. I mean, even in something like Transformers 4, which is terrible, Transformers Age of Extinction, it's really bad. But it's a Michael Bay movie, so it takes a certain kind of risk.
Right. And you know what you're getting when you go to see that. Right?
And you also exactly know what you're getting when you see it.
Before I let you go, best film you've seen in the past 90 days, the past summer?
The summer, I mean, the movie that has stuck with me the most is a movie called is Snowpiercer, which we talked about before.
Oh, yeah.
And then Richard Linklater's Boyhood, which I don't think is a great movie.
Really?
You know, it's shaggy. I think the formal idea behind the project is really interesting. But I think there are some things in that movie that just blew me away emotionally.
Right.
You want to talk about an epic and a blockbuster, I mean, for something that probably didn't cost that much money to make but devote that much time to.
Right. I mean, you know, they filmed it in real time, right? Like 12 years or whatever.
Yes, over 12 years. But I mean, Richard Linklater's sort of philosophy about the world and his movie-making aesthetic is really astounding.
Wesley Morris, he writes on films for Grantland. Thank you, Wesley.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
In 2012, about 2,500 farms harvested the K word, which is up from fewer than 1,000 in 2007.
K is for kale, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials had another 60-point day, y'all, up 1%, finished at 17,039. The NASDAQ added 5 points, about 0.1%, 45.32. The S&P 500 gained 5 points, 0.25%, ended at 1992. That right there, that's a record high. Sears, Sears, Sears. What are we to do with you? Sears Holdings, which owns Sears and Kmart stores, sank 7% today after reporting a nearly billion-dollar loss the first half of the year. Since the two chains combined, shares are down 82% from their high, and still there are somehow 2,000 stores. Eagle Bulk Shipping. It will take your cement, grain, or iron ore across the ocean. It has filed for bankruptcy, but floated 4.6% higher today. Somehow, you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. On this day in 1846, the U.S. welcomed the land of enchantment, New Mexico. In 1989, Neptune's first ring was discovered. And it's National Hug Your Boss Day. So give your boss a big hug and don't feel like a creep for it. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The school district of Philadelphia has a budget gap of more than $80 million. Among the cost-saving measures being voted on at a meeting tonight is this one. The district wants to stop letting high schoolers who live within 2 miles of campus take the school bus. Kate Davidson has more on the changing economics of school transportation.
Paying for your kids' trip to school can definitely add up. Before today's vote in Philly, public school mom Helen Gim, an activist, worried about more parents paying bus fare.
It's $2.25 each way.
Multiply that by two trips a day over the school year, and she says a family
would have to pay $810 a year per child.
Now, that's the cash price Gim is quoting, but even cheaper token fares add up to hundreds of dollars. The idea of state and district cuts to transportation support is hardly new. In fact, Michael Griffith with the Education Commission of the States says the big cuts came from the recession and have waned.
But they're not going back to the levels before the recession.
He says states and districts want to put money back into other areas first, like teachers.
So they're looking to replenish those areas that were cut that directly impact student learning. And there really isn't the money available in most districts to go back and put it into programs in areas like transportation.
Marguerite Rosa with Georgetown University says it's all about trade-offs. She says higher transportation spending in and of itself isn't necessarily the goal.
If you're not spending the money on transportation, then you get to spend it on something else. So is the higher transportation spending bringing greater student outcomes, or is it bringing lower student outcomes? Because that means there's less spending on math.
Though when subsidized school transportation goes away, families may have to do more math to get through it. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
All right, so here is a story about, and I'm dead serious about this, it's about fluid dynamics, about what happens as the planet gets warmer and oceans rise and saltwater forces its way into places where freshwater is used for agriculture. Farmers in the rice paddies of Vietnam rely on freshwater to grow about a fifth of the world's supply of rice, and the changing climate has been a disaster for some of them. For others, it's an opportunity. Christopher Johnson went to the Mekong River Delta to see how they're adapting.
It's the rainy season here in Chande. About a dozen field workers have squished out into a green paddy that goes on for more than 2.5 football fields. They chatter in Khmer, mostly about the way-too-close radio reporter, as they bend low and pull young rice plants from their monsoon-soaked beds and toss them into piles for replanting.
I was born in this area. I'm from this area. I learned from my father and my grandfather from the time I was a kid how to grow rice.
A 64-year-old farmer named Ming is renting the land to grow his crop.
Rice is good. You can always eat it, and it's reliable.
At least right now it is. But things will change when the dry season starts in January. That's when farmers here usually start raising a rice crop that typically relies on fresh water they pump or channel in from some branch of the Mekong River. But the dry season's been getting drier, and the South China Sea, less than a mile away, it's rising and pushing up into empty river and stream beds. What little fresh water there is goes salty. So does the soil. And once that happens, rice farmers like Ming know their crops are history.
This village is affected by saline intrusion. During the dry season, people here can't do anything with the land. They just leave it, go somewhere else and work, or try to find some work locally.
If Ming risks planting a dry season crop, he could earn more than $2,000. But he won't take that chance. Instead of fighting saline intrusion, he's found a way to hedge his bets and make some money off climate change. He's gone and bought himself a shrimp farm. So is this farmer, named Sung. Standing beside two shrimp ponds out behind his house, Sung fires up what looks like a system of small spinning steamboat paddles. They're adding oxygen to an opaque brown pool. This same salty water that's killing off the region's rice, the shrimp, somewhere down at the bottom, are loving it. They can earn Sung in a year more than four times what an average rice farmer brings home.
In a good year, I do two crops. If it hits, I get $4,720 from these two ponds. This is the only thing I can do. Growing rice is not very profitable.
The biggest option available to people here in these areas that are affected by saline intrusion is to, you know, abandon rice altogether and to switch from rice to saltwater shrimp.
Tim Gorman is a Cornell grad student researching how people's lives in the Mekong Delta are being changed by global warming.
You know, for some people, a really winning strategy. I mean, you just driving around here, you can see that there are, you know, big new houses. You see some nice new cars. And so you have some people who really have made, you know, a lot of money from growing shrimp, which is primarily exported to markets in Europe and Asia and the U.S.
Shrimp farmer Sung isn't doing quite that well. He's helping his daughter pay for college, but there's no fat new Mercedes in the driveway. That kind of money goes mostly to big-time farmers. Some people earn tens of thousands of dollars a year in the shrimp trade. With the lure of five- and six-figure profits, plus faltering rice crops killed off by rising seas, Tim Gorman says some folks are even taking hammers to the very gates and dikes set up to protect the area from the ocean.
People are actually actively, in some places, manipulating the infrastructure, sabotaging the infrastructure, and actually allow salt water to come in, not just during the dry season, but all year, so that they can switch from freshwater rice farming to saltwater shrimp farming.
Shrimp is no sure bet either. Seeds, antibiotics, aeration systems, startup costs, kilo for kilo, it's way more expensive to raise than rice. A few sick ones can take out a whole pond. Sung says he's gone bust before.
In a bad year, all I have left are the whites of my hands.
That's the risk for most farmers here, rice or shrimp or anything else. But more and more, those who can afford it are moving away from rice and putting their money down on a changing climate. I'm Christopher Johnson in the Mekong Delta in South Vietnam.
Christopher Johnson is a reporter for Burn, an energy journal from Sound Vision Productions, with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. You are what you eat, the old saw goes, and it does make a certain amount of sense. Eat healthy, be healthy. About a third of Americans, say the people at Nielsen, believe food can be used in place of some medicines, superfoods specifically, and we are increasingly buying in to the theoretical superpowers of superfoods. Vanessa Wong writes on food and the business thereof for Bloomberg Businessweek. Vanessa, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
One ought best begin, I suppose, by trying to define what a superfood is, but that is tricky, yeah?
Indeed, that is kind of the dilemma right now. people love superfoods, as you know, we kind of vaguely understand them. But what is a superfood is an excellent question. There is a study recently published in Preventing Chronic Diseases that tried to define superfoods. They ended up highlighting certain unexpected foods like iceberg lettuce.
Yeah, I know. And you get, I mean, what is that? Like 90% water iceberg lettuce, isn't it?
It's some water, it's some fiber, but it's also got vitamin K, vitamin A, and some potassium.
We will, I should say, not talk about kale on this radio program, just on a stand-on principle on my part. But there are others out there that are a little bit surprising, right? Tomatoes, carrots, strawberries, oranges. I mean, there's, you know, let alone quinoa and wheat berry and I don't know, pomegranate.
That's right. According to the study, though, the most nutrient-dense foods are actually watercress, Chinese cabbage, beet greens, spinach. So things that don't actually get as much buzz as the pomegranates, the quinoas. However, it's also interesting that as much as people believe in the power of food, half of people surveyed by Nielsen said that they weren't willing to give up taste for health.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, and I think, honestly, that's where I am. But that's, you know, that's a whole different deal. Farmers are seeing this trend and they're turning over crops and planting extra, you know, quinoa and all that stuff, aren't they?
Indeed. I know that we are not supposed to speak of kale on the show.
Just we'll call it the K word, all right?
The K word. So in 2012, about 2,500 farms harvested the K word, which is up from fewer than 1,000 in 2007.
Since you have broached the topic, far and away, the K word is the thing that people eat. It beats by miles and miles and miles Brussels sprouts, kohlrabi, spinach, chard, and arugula.
Exactly. I mean, those also grew at a very fast pace if we're talking just, you know, vegetable sales. You know, they all grew from between 10 and 15% annually. But kale, the K word is skyrocketing ahead of them.
I will tell you, just by way of closing and in the spirit of true confessions, K word chips, you put them in the oven, 450, a little olive oil, salt. Boom. Delicious.
Yum.
I'm just, you know, I'm being completely honest here.
Well, it's good. Keep an open mind, right?
Vanessa Wong of Bloomberg Businessweek. Thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the lawyers are why we can't have anything nice edition. You know the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, right? If not, Google is your friend here. Anyway, what started out as and has actually been so far an amazingly successful viral awareness and fundraising campaign is now getting lawyered up. The Associated Press got its hands on a State Department cable that forbids ambassadors and other high-ranking Foreign Service officers from taking the challenge because, and here's the quote, federal ethics rules bar officials from using public office for private gain, no matter how worthy the cause, which I get, but still, come on, will you? All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this, what are we, Thursday? Today, yes. Today, the Dow up 60 points, about a third percent, 17,039. The NASDAQ added 5 points, about a tenth percent, 45.32. The S&P 500 gained 5 points, a quarter percent, 1992. That is a record. John Buckley, Kim Bowie, John Haas, Patty Hearst, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.